91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Some 8 million stray dog winds up in U.S. shelters each year. Only half make it out. If but 5% of the funds allocated for pickup housing and euthanizing were spent for free spay-neuter clinics, 4 million animals need never be put down. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Today we'll speak with the biography of the amazing Greg Maley of Ohio. He's personally saved some 30,000 dogs from abandonment and the needle. We'll learn how he pulls that off in a few minutes. Our guest is journalist Peter Zeutlin, who's chronicled how Greg Maley drives an 18-wheeler down south each month to pick up packs of hard luck dogs. You'll love the story after the news.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. This afternoon, we learn more about incredible rescue missions. No, not ones by U.S. Rangers or SEALs or commandos, but those of the canine variety.
With us is journalist and author Peter Zeutlin, who's written about an Ohio man who regularly rescues dogs by the truckload. Literally, truckload.
That man is Greg Maley, and he transports hard luck, desperate rescue dogs to safe, new loving homes by an 18-wheeler, to be exact.
Peter Zeutlin has written Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and a Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway. Peter joins us now via Skype from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Peter Zeutlin.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And thank you so much, really, for writing this book and bringing to light the enormous and chronic problem of pet overpopulation and the importance of spaying and neutering. And although, God, the book was so heartbreaking at times, there's also a lot of joy and hope in it. But I'd like you to begin, Peter, with your own very touching account of lowering your own, as you call it, Berlin Wall against having a dog and your beloved Albie, who was in a high-kill shelter on death row.
And that's really, it was Albie who really led me into this story. I had resisted for 20 years all the pleas of my wife and then my kids to get a family dog. And the barrier finally dropped when we took care of a friend's black lab for the weekend, very sweet dog named Riley. And I finally raised the white flag of surrender and I said, let's get a dog. And when my wife came home one day and said something about a rescue dog, I must have looked incredulous because I had no idea what she was talking about. I thought of St. Bernard's in the Alps. That's how little I knew about all of this. And we ended up adopting an incredibly sweet yellow lab who was in a shelter in Louisiana. And he came to us on Greg Maley's truck, and that led me into the story.
Now, how did she find out about Greg Maley in the truck?
When Albie was en route with Greg, my wife came running in one day, and she said, look at this. And there was a picture on Facebook of Albie sitting with Greg. He had his paws in Albie's, in Greg's lap. And Greg had written the most touching Facebook post about it. And that's when I realized this was not just some truck driver. He wrote that he and Albie had to relax. And he told Albie how excited he was for Albie. And that they were in the north and he was almost home. And I was really touched by what he wrote. And I didn't even meet him at that point. I didn't even know his name at that point. But I thought, this is really a guy who's dedicated to his work, a guy who loves what he does. And after Albie had been with us for a while, I realized that Greg might very well be a window into this whole world of rescue, which I knew nothing about, but which, because of our experience with Albie, I'd become very interested in. I was meeting people, you know, I was walking Albie, and it seemed like everybody I met up here had a dog from Tennessee or Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. And I was wondering, why were there all these dogs up here from the southern states?
Well, Peter, we're going to get to that, and we're certainly going to address that because it is a very important part of your book. But I just wanted you to explain what your beliefs were about rescue dogs, other than the St. Bernard with the flask and all that. Yeah. But many people think they are damaged animals, yeah. damaged goods, basically. Yep. And purebred dogs are somehow better, those from a breeder. So what did you find out?
Well, I had all the same misconceptions. You know, I said, well, I don't know what about a rescue dog, a shelter dog. We don't know anything about its history. It could have temperament problems. It could have health problems. And what I learned that it simply isn't the case. So many of these, you know, first of all, if you work with a reputable rescue organization, these dogs are carefully vetted. They are up to date on their vaccinations. They are temperament tested. There are purebred rescue dogs. There are mixed breed rescue dogs. Generally speaking, one thing that I learned is that mixed breed dogs tend to have fewer health and behavior problems than many purebred dogs, who, if they're, you know, highly bred for a particular function, if they're herding dogs, for example, and they end up in a Manhattan apartment where they're not going to hurt anything, you know, they can get a little bit out of sorts. So I had all the same misconceptions. And yet, you know, over the, you know, past couple of years, I've met so many rescue dogs that you would just want to reach out to and bring into your home.
Peter, I have a little technical question here. You sound very boomy on the air here. Could you maybe move a little closer to your mic?
Or is it further?
Maybe that would
help
out a little bit.
Is that better?
I think it is a little better.
Yeah, good. That's better.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so all of a sudden you have Albie and your life changes and you have these questions about what was his life like before and all that. How did that lead you into writing this book?
Well, you know, when I looked at Albie, there were a lot of questions I would have liked to have asked him. You know, I wanted to know if he had a family. I wanted to know if he'd run away. I wanted to know if he'd been discarded. And I really wanted to know if anyone had hurt him. But he couldn't answer those questions for me. So I wanted to learn as much about him as I could, possibly by going down south to where he came from, see if I could meet the people who had actually had a hand in saving his life. But I also wanted to know more about dogs like him. You know, how did they come to us? Who has to extend their hands and their hearts to these dogs just to get them to Greg Maley's truck? So it was all those questions I had about Albie in particular, which I wasn't optimistic about answering, but the questions I had about dogs like Albie in general that I thought I probably could answer that led me on this journey.
And talk about how Greg Maley got involved in rescue, because that itself is a story.
Yes. I mean, for Greg, it was a bit of luck, I guess you would say, or serendipity. Greg was operating 5 small family restaurants with his mother in Central Ohio. Those eventually closed one by one. And about 10 years ago, he got a call from his sister, Kathy, who runs a lab rescue, actually the rescue we adopted Albie through. Labs for Rescue, based in Connecticut. And she called him one night. She had someone driving dogs up north from the south, and they were stuck in Ohio. They were exhausted. It was snowing. And she called Greg and said, "Can you help?" So he drove out to the interstate and ended up driving that woman. It was a woman transporting the dogs, driving her and the dogs all the way to New England overnight. And, you know, he started doing this, making more runs down south as a favor to his sister. And he began to think, you know, I think this could be better organized. I think this could be systematized. And so he started doing it on a regular basis. And that eventually evolved into Rescue Road Trips, the name of his outfit.
Obviously, Greg isn't necessarily a person of great means, and a tank of gas for an 18-wheeler is about $500. So this is quite a monetary output just to...
This question comes up a lot. You know, I mean, Greg charges to transport each dog, but it is a shoestring operation. You know, I've heard some people do the math and they think he's, you know, just raking it in. But first of all, the rig is enormously expensive to finance. It's enormously expensive to operate. It's an older, older rig that needs constant repairs. He does this trip 4,200 miles from Ohio to New England and back every other week. So that's 8,500 miles every month. And depending on the price of gas and diesel, it can run $7,000 a month just for gas. He's got a backup driver to pay. You know, it's just the expenses are endless. And, you know, if he doesn't have 55 dogs on board, he doesn't even break even, but he makes the trip. He'll make that trip if there are 10 dogs who have reservations to travel. Doesn't matter. He's just committed every other week.
And it is, he has his wife, Adela. He has his son, Connor.
Yes.
Why? I mean, it's, you know, he, tell us why his devotion and commitment, what you found about him, his devotion and commitment, despite the pain and suffering,
yes.
Not only the work involved in cleaning that truck and in bringing the dogs and in transporting the dogs, but all the pain and suffering he's witnessed doing this.
You know, it's a very stressful job. You're carrying the hopes and dreams of people waiting for their dogs. He's carrying all the pressure of these dogs who've gotten a second chance just to get to his trailer. So it's a huge responsibility. He and Adela actually, they met when she worked in the restaurants that he used to run, but they didn't marry. When they married, let me put it that way, he was well into running rescue road trips. So it's been a part of their life, you know, pretty much since they've been dating, and then after they got married. It's a very hard separation every other week. He's away from his wife and his stepson for half of his life. But he just also loves the dogs, and he loves the world that he's created. He just gets enormous satisfaction and joy out of it. So it is an enormous sacrifice, but they're all on board. You know, Adela's incredibly supportive, and it's a very touching and strong marriage.
I was wondering what Greg Maley was like, his demeanor and presence. It also seems by the accompanying material that he's not really into much publicity. He didn't get a ghostwriter to write this book as, you know, my autobiography or
right.
anything.
No, I approached him. You know, he's gotten his fair share of publicity over the years. But one of the things that he's really quick to point out and emphasize to me over and over, he said, look, I am just the last link in a long chain of people that it takes to save a dog. And he's the face of this to the people who are adopting up north, because he gets to play Santa Claus every other Saturday and deliver these dogs to their waiting families. So the adopters associate him with the process, and they may never even know the names of 90% of the people who had a role in saving their dog. So, you know, he's always very quick to point out that he's just one piece of this much bigger puzzle. You know, so no, he didn't seek the publicity. I sought him out because I thought he had a great story, and that he also was the way into a bigger story. He was the one who could open up this whole world of rescue for me, introduce me to the people who get the dogs to his truck, the people that meet him along the way. To help him walk the dogs. It's another fascinating part of the story.
The angels.
These are groups of volunteers who meet Greg every other week in Birmingham, Alabama, Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Rocky Hill, Connecticut. Come, you know, no matter how bad the weather is, they're out there to meet the truck. You know, he runs on a regular schedule. They give the dogs an extended break. They walk them. They love them. They lift the dog's spirits. They lift Greg's spirits. They lift their own spirits. And, you know, they play a vital role in this sort of underground railroad, too. And again, you know, the adopters up north will never know who they are, except hopefully maybe through this book. So, it's, you know, it's really kind of a combination of, you know, it's Greg's livelihood, such as it is, but it's also a mission. And it's a mission for a lot of good people.
Well, we're going to get to some of the unsung heroes that you mention in your book in a bit. We're speaking with Peter Zeutlin. He's a journalist whose work has appeared regularly in the Boston Globe and the Christian Science Monitor. And he's written Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and A Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway, which I'm happy to report is now a New York Times bestseller. So, Peter, let's get to the problem of the pet overpopulation in the South, the abuse of animals in the South, so much more pronounced than in the North. It's like a culture clash, and it's very complicated. And of course, it's not everybody in the South, all people in the South versus the North, but it is an issue. So let's address that now.
Yeah, you know, I'm always, and you're right. I mean, you have to be very careful talking about this. Look, many of the heroes of this book are Southern.
Exactly.
And they are the people who educated me about why the dog overpopulation problem is particularly acute in the South. So I don't want to paint this with too broad a brush, but, you know, it might be worth sharing, you know, not to bog this down in numbers, but just to give people a sense of scale. The shelter where Albie was lucky to survive serves a population of about 155,000 people. In 2013, that shelter euthanized 3,000 dogs, about 90% of those that came in. In the entire state of New Jersey, with 9 million people, 58 times greater, just over 4,000 dogs were euthanized in New Jersey shelters that same year. 58 times the population, but they euthanized just 1.5 times the number of dogs. In Dade County, population 2.6 million people. In 2010, which is the most recent year I could get statistics, over 22,000 dogs were impounded, almost 9,000 euthanized. Mm. So, you know, from a statistical point of view, this is a more dramatic problem in the South. There's no disputing that. And, you know, the problem has complex causes. It's social, cultural, economic, it's political, even climate plays a small role in this, because dogs can, who are roaming freely, can breed all year. The females tend to go through menstrual cycles more often. So, and dogs that might perish in a harsher climate can survive in a southern climate on their own. So, you know, it's an enormous problem. Some people, particularly up north, are shocked when I tell them that it's not just a rural problem, that Houston, for example, has 1.2 million strays living on the streets. And that's
staggering.
Yeah, the city concurs with that estimate. Miami has a big problem as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not just an urban, I'm sorry, it's just not a rural problem. You know, the bottom line for me was that Southerners told me that the root of the problem is that for many people, a dog is quote unquote just a dog, which implies that it's disposable, it's not valued. By no means is this true. Many Southerners love their pets, they adore them, they take great care of them. You know, spay neuter is obviously in some ways at the root of this problem. Up north, you know, over the last 40 or 50 years, the shelters have become less crowded. There are shelters at humane societies in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, that now have excess capacity, and they are bringing dogs from the South. And that's why the transports, such as Greg's and there are others, they run from the South to the North. There are no transports bringing dogs from New England to the southern states. People I talked to said it's going to take a long time to get their hands around this problem. It's going to take, and they all cite education as the number one necessity. People need to learn how to have more compassion for their animals, how to take better care of them, to spay neuter. You know, free spay neuter clinics or low cost spay neuter clinics are critical. But when you've got a million dogs on the streets of a city like Houston, you almost can't adopt or spay neuter your way out of the problem except over many, many years.
You know, I was thinking, Peter, because as you talk about the education being so important, I wondered if you've even thought about perhaps working with some school districts in some of these southern cities and maybe offering your book as part of the curriculum.
Well, there are actually some of the rescue organizations that I profiled in the book do have pilot programs in the schools. They do see it as critical to get in and teach young kids that the way that they are used to seeing or observing dogs in their community and the way people tend to live with dogs in their community is not the only way. So they bring service dogs into school. They have the kids read books that have messages about responsible care of animals to the dogs. They give them a certificate, a stuffed animal. It's a small thing. But some of these organizations are, in fact, trying to partner with animal control departments and school districts to teach kids a different way. You know, some people said to me, look, and these were Southerners, again, it's very hard to change old ways in the South, and it's going to take a really long time, but we do have to get to the kids.
Exactly. So let's go to the trip. You decide to travel. You travel 7,000 miles in the back cab of this semi, a 42-foot trailer, 80 dogs, which, of course, he does very often, from Ohio to the South to Putnam, Connecticut. Talk about all those challenges and the papers and dealing with the dogs and the noise and all of it.
Well, I think what people have to realize is that, you know, if you're a truck driver, and you're transporting bottled water or automobile parts, it's a lot easier than transporting 80 rescue dogs. You know, those dogs have to get out for regular walks. And except when the angels are there that we talked about, it's Greg and one other guy, a backup driver. We're on the trips that I was there, it was me, three of us, getting 80 dogs out for a short walk in Louisiana and, you know, Virginia. It's a very demanding physical job. So Greg leaves on a Monday from his home in Ohio. They stop that night, usually in Tennessee, you know, usually an empty trailer, unless there's a dog that, occasionally there's a dog that needs to be transported south. Maybe it's being returned to a rescue group. And by the next night, they're in place and ready to start picking up dogs on Wednesday. And these are dogs that, I want to make it clear, he's not scooping off the street. These are dogs that have been rescued by rescue organizations. Either some of them are based in New England, they have volunteers in the South, or they're rescue organizations that are based in the South. And they're dogs that have already been placed in homes for adoption up north or are going to foster homes up north.
And they've had exams and shots and such.
Yes, they have to be spayed and neutered. They have to be current on all their shots. There's a lot of regulation. There's, you know, they need an interstate travel certificate signed by a licensed veterinarian. You know, look, the system isn't perfect. Can a dog get sick? Yes, a dog can get sick. Greg has an amazingly successful rate. I think of the 30,000 dogs, more than 30,000 he's transported, only five have not survived the trip. Because of illness that was, you know, maybe they were incubating or whatever. That's over 99.9% success rate. It's pretty extraordinary. But, you know, so these are dogs that have been carefully vetted by these rescue organizations. Look, it doesn't serve anyone's interest to send a dog with obvious behavioral problems or a sick dog up to a home. A reputable rescue organization wants to make sure they do everything they can to make these adoptions successful. But you have to deal with reputable rescue organizations, and we can talk about that later. But so Greg has various stops. The route has changed since I traveled with him a little bit. And the first pickups begin usually in Austin, Texas. And he drives, you know, through Texas into Louisiana, picking up dogs at appointed pickup points. And it's really something to see these dogs get on board. They, you know, some of them, they're raring to go. Some of them seem to know something good is about to happen. I mean, you get some that are fearful. some that are a little bit nervous, but it's amazing how smoothly it goes for the most part. And you know, it's a noisy job when the dogs are getting on board. They're very excited. What I found really remarkable is how quiet it gets at night. They tend to settle down after about 20 minutes when it's time to crawl into the sleeping bag in the trailer and go to sleep. And Greg, by the way, sleeps in the trailer with the dogs. He's hands-on. He really wants to be sure he knows what's going on in that trailer. And, you know, the trailer is never unattended. The dogs settle in. I mean, occasionally there's one that'll keep you up at night, as it did me. Greg can sleep through anything because he's so exhausted from the driving. And as you make your way north, the excitement just builds. And Greg makes sure the excitement builds for the people who are waiting by making very frequent use of Facebook. As I mentioned earlier, we were able to follow Albie's journey north, and he documents every one of these trips as he goes, when he's not driving, posting pictures of the dogs and encouraging people to have their welcome signs ready. And he really wants this to be the biggest holiday you've ever had when you get to pick up your dog at the end of the run. And it's, you know, it's really quite inspiring to see the care and the passion that he brings to this, and the way he connects people with their dogs days before they ever arrive in their, you know, in their arms.
I guess he gets some yellow ribbons.
Yeah, I mean, he's just, I mean, I, you know, I was so impressed with him, and, you know, he was so thoughtful about every aspect of what he does. And I think his use of Facebook is symbolic of that. You know, he's not just moving dogs from point A to point B. He knows these dogs are the misfits, the discards, the throwaways, somebody's trash, dogs that were all going to die. And they've been given this second lease on life. And he takes that really to heart and everything he does in his operation.
We're speaking with Peter Zeitlin, a journalist, and he's written Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and a Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway. We're going to take a short break on today's topical currents, and we'll be right back with more.
And we're back with Peter Zeitlin. We're talking about his book, Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and a Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway. Of course, we're talking about Peter Malin and his driving.
Greg Malin.
Greg Malin. I'm sorry. I keep saying Peter for Zeitlin.
I just want to spell Greg Malin's name.
M-A-H-L-E.
And I just want to point out that if you go to facebook.com/rescueroadtrips, you can follow Greg Malin and see all about the new tractor trailer he needs. And that would be great.
As you mentioned, Peter, Miami has a tremendous stray dog population. We see that. I don't mean to pick on any geographic area, but particularly the Houston Fifth Ward population. What's that like there in the Fifth Ward?
Yeah, I spent an evening walking through the Fifth Ward of Houston with two volunteers from an organization called Forgotten Dogs of the Fifth Ward. And the Fifth Ward is one of Houston's poorest, most dangerous neighborhoods. I'd really never seen anything quite like it. You know, we could walk down a street that seemed to be empty of people and dogs, and then turn around and all of a sudden you'd see a dozen dogs following you. It seemed to materialize from absolutely nowhere, but they were coming out from under cars, from behind bushes, from under abandoned houses. And these volunteers go in there to try and just to make small improvements in the lives of the dogs that live there. They leave food on street corners. They will vaccinate dogs as they go to the extent they can. You know, there's some that they follow regularly. And if they find a dog that's really in distress, they will take it off the street and try and find a foster home, nurse it back to health, and maybe get it ready to make the trip on Greg's truck. You know, it was just the third, it's like a third world country in the Fifth Ward, you know, just miles away from downtown Houston, which is a booming city. Well, one of the things that really struck me, you know, living up in New England, I can't remember in the last 40 or 50 years ever seeing a male dog that hadn't been neutered. Mm-hmm. But when we were walking through the Fifth Ward, I didn't see a single male dog out of many dozens that was neutered. So the Fifth Ward is a pretty dispiriting place. And, you know, they're dealing with an incredible problem. You know, the big shelter in Houston is located in the Fifth Ward. There are things that can be done, you know, to improve the situation. And that shelter actually has improved a lot. It used to be an absolute disaster. You know, it was a dumping ground not only for dogs, but for city employees who couldn't make it anywhere else. But they've really made great strides over the last few years, including, by the way, building, I don't know if it's open yet, it was under construction when I was there, a new adoption center, much more customer user friendly, to help increase the number of dogs that they can adopt out. You know, we can talk, I mean, there are things that, you know, you see glimmers of hope. For example, in St. Martin Parish in Louisiana, a new director of animal control came in there. She didn't come up through animal control. She was in retail. And she's reversed the euthanasia rate. It was from 80% euthanasia rate to 20 survival rate, and she's flipped that by reaching out and building a whole network of rescues that she works with. You know, people working in these facilities often, they're good people. They're not, you know, they're trying to do their best, but they're dealing with a lot of social irresponsibility around them. And what do you do when you have hundreds of dogs coming into a big urban shelter day after day after day, and you don't have room for them? You know, that's what drives up the euthanasia rates.
Right.
And, you know, you've got to work on both ends of this. One is to, you know, how do you lower the intake rate? And also, how do you increase, you know, on the other side, how do you increase your adoption rates? How do you help people maybe surrendering a dog for financial reasons? How do you help them keep their dog? You know, if, instead of euthanizing the dog, what if you had a budget to help them maybe get through some tough times and keep their dog? You know, there are things that are being done. There's an interesting program, actually, if people saw a great article in the New York Times yesterday called How Smart Animal Shelters Aim for Zero Kill. And it talks about an organization called Target Zero, and they're working with cities all over the country, including Jacksonville, Florida, making great strides in reducing euthanasia rates, mainly by building partnerships, helping these animal control departments build partnerships with rescue groups, offering low-cost spay and neuter, for example, in the community.
They're doing a lot in Miami, actually. Mm-hmm. They did, what was it, Joe, the referendum for the no-kill policy?
Yes. It was to provide additional funding for animals.
Yes, I think that was Pets Trust Miami that
put
a referendum on the
similar
ballot.
Similar to our Children's Trust Association.
Yes, and there's also Urgent Dogs of Miami, which is doing good work down there. I'm not intimately familiar with the rescue community in South Florida. I didn't spend time there working on this book. But there are lots of good organizations. You know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact, too, that nationally we are euthanizing a far fewer number of dogs and cats than we were 40 years ago. In 1970, according to the Humane Society of the United States, we euthanized 15 million dogs and cats. In 2013, that number was 3.4 million. Mm. So we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we've made great strides, you know, nationally. There are still pockets where the problem is quite acute.
I'm wondering, Peter, about Houston in particular, are they making any attempts to ameliorate the problem, or is it that they're dealing with the unfortunate human beings who are living in such desperate or deplorable situations that they're dealing with that and then not necessarily or therefore not dealing with the
animals? You know, I don't want to make this too political, but I can tell you that the people who live in the Fifth Ward, they're as neglected as the animals in certain ways. I mean,
that's what I mean.
You can't even, you look around, it doesn't look like the city even picks up the trash there anymore. So this whole problem is interwoven with some of our deeper socioeconomic problems in this country. It's not easy to solve. The other thing I would say is that in terms of politics is that, dogs don't vote. And so it can be very difficult to persuade a cash-strapped municipality or, government entity to devote the resources that might be needed to deal with this problem when they can't even meet their infrastructure or, human needs, or they don't have enough money for schools and teachers,
right, exactly,
and fire departments. So this doesn't necessarily become, a top-line priority for a lot of places. But it is a public health issue too. I mean, one of the things they did in Houston was, if I'm not mistaken, the Bureau of Animal Regulation and Control, BARC, if you will, jurisdiction was transferred to the Department of Public Health. Because this is also a public health issue too, particularly in places where you've got a lot of dogs in an urban area, just living, wild on the streets. As I said, though, Houston BARC, the shelter, really has made great strides. The euthanasia rate is much lower than it was. It's not low enough to, to make everyone happy, but there have been improvements. I mean, I've talked to people who were familiar with the shelter before and after, and I met some of the people who work there now. They seem very motivated, very compassionate, very energetic, which from the folks I talked to was light years from where it used to be.
We're speaking with Peter Zeitlin about his book, Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and a Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway. Francis writes, our family presently are raising 3 rescue dogs, 4 cats, family members, really. Yes, sometimes it's a little bit consuming, but it's the best time I've ever had.
I think that's called the Wild Kingdom.
If you want to join in, are you aware of this massive problem of homeless animals in the southern United States in particular, or are you the parent of a rescue animal? Did you have preconceptions about rescue dogs? 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or radio@wlrn.org for email. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Peter Zeitlin, a journalist who's written Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and a Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway. And Peter, it's rescueroadbook@gmail.com, your email?
Yes.
Okay, so, let's talk about the importance of, not just the transporting of the dogs, but that the transport company is reputable as well. Not only the shelter, but the transport company.
That's right. As in every endeavor, there are good operators and bad operators. If you went out to, get a contractor for your house, or you needed a doctor or a lawyer, there are good ones, there are bad ones. There are several great transport operations out there. What you need to be wary of, however, are people, some of them with good intentions, some not, who are simply going down south and cramming a lot of dogs or puppies into a van, parking in a parking lot in Connecticut, and selling dogs. That is not the way to go. That's a recipe for disaster. A licensed transport, registered in the state where you're picking up the dog, making sure that that transport has all of the health records ready to hand to you. Ask around. I mean, often the adopters don't actually engage the transporter directly. That's done by the rescue organization that you adopt through. But if you're interested in rescuing a dog, if you're not going to go to your local shelter, but you're going to adopt through an organization like Houston Shaggy Dog Rescue or Labs for Rescue in Connecticut, ask around. talk to people who have rescue dogs, see what their experience was. Talk to your veterinarian. They are often a great source of information. You know, just to ask the same kind of questions you would about hiring a contractor, a lawyer, or a doctor. You know, because you can find out a lot about who's reputable and who isn't.
In your travels with Greg, you saw, I would say, some of the best and the worst that mankind has to offer.
Oh boy, yes.
And how did that affect you? How does it affect Greg and the others behind the scenes? Because you're all faced with knowing that you can only do so much. You can only, I mean, for every dog that Greg saves, for example, he's saving a life, but there are many that he can't.
Right. Greg will be the first to tell you, look, he says, and this is echoed by everyone I talk to, I'm not changing the world. You know, I'm like moving grains of sand off the beach one at a time because the problem is so big. And for the people in the trenches, people like Kathy Wetmore of Houston Shaggy Dog, who walks these shelters every week, or a woman named Carrie Toth, who's our adoption coordinator for Albie, now with the Central Louisiana Alliance for Animals. These folks go see such heartache and such suffering. I mean, Carrie took me to dumpster sites where she routinely finds litters of puppies, I hate to say this, but discarded in dumpsters. And, you know, you just see a lot of horrible stuff. And, you know, I'll tell you, the people who do this work, they're happy for every dog they save. They lie awake at night haunted by the faces of the ones they left behind. But the problem is so overwhelming, they can't take them all. You know, it's kind of a Sophie's choice for them every day. You walk through a shelter with 50 wonderful adoptable dogs, and you've got, you know, room at your own house or a foster's house for two or three. You know, it's heartbreaking work with difficult choices. And a lot of people, you know, suffer compassion fatigue at some point. It's draining, and the sacrifice that they make. Carrie, I mean, she has drained bank accounts. She almost lost her marriage over this work. Didn't take a family vacation for 18 years because she couldn't pull herself away. You know, and I'll tell you another thing. It's interesting because very often these rescue organizations have far more invested financially in getting these dogs healthy and ready for adoption than they ever charged an adoption fee. Sometimes you'll hear people say, well, why am I paying a $300, $400 adoption fee for a rescue dog? I saw dogs that had thousands of dollars of veterinary care before they were ever put up for adoption. So, you know, their sacrifices are enormous. You know, Greg Maley will tell you that he has the best job in rescue, because he gets to see all the happy scenes play out at the end of the run when those dogs meet their families.
Gotcha Day.
New Jersey. Gotcha Day. It's called Gotcha Day. And, you know, because we don't know, in many cases you don't know a rescue dog's real birthday. Their lives are pretty much a mystery. Gotcha Day sort of becomes their alternate birthday. And, you know, so Greg gets to see all that happy stuff at the end, which, by the way, is one of the reasons he makes use of Facebook so regularly. It's not just, as I mentioned, to build the excitement for the adopters who are waiting at the end of the line. It's so people like Carrie and Kathy Wetmore, who do this tough work, can experience the happy endings vicariously by following Greg's trips on Facebook.
I read something before this program about that, considering the amount of money to catch these animals, to store them, to treat them, and ultimately possibly euthanize them, that if 5% of that money was spent to create very, very low-cost spay and neuter centers, it could just about be that there would be no more euthanasia.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on that. It's a complicated formula. And, you know, I did talk to one shelter director I mentioned earlier in St. Martin Parish in Louisiana. You know, she had a pretty hefty line item in her budget. It's not a huge budget because it's a small parish, but for euthanasia. And she said, you know, why don't I take some of that money and reallocate it to try and expand my adoption program? Mm. And she said, I didn't ask for permission. You know, it was quite clear what it was for. And she just said, you know, this makes no sense. I'm going to take some of this money, euthanize fewer dogs, and put the effort into adoption. That's on a small scale. You know, you've got many different jurisdictions. You know, this is usually dealt with at the county or the, you know, municipality level. You know, so these calculations are probably different in every location. But I do think there are solutions out there. As I said, there's groups like Target Zero and the whole no-kill movement that, you know, are working with these shelters to find better ways to address this problem. You know, you just, as I said, you want to slow the influx because it's the overcrowding that's become such a huge problem, and then also accelerate and magnify the different ways that you can get these dogs out. And that's why these partnerships are so important. You know, sometimes you get a shelter director, maybe he's been there 30, 40 years, and they're used to doing things a certain way, and it's going to be a lot of work to try and change things and, you know, form these alliances with rescue groups up in New England. But if you make the effort, you can reduce the euthanasia rate.
You know, Peter, another subject which you tackle in the book is hoarding, animal hoarding. And it's a very fine line because many people think they're doing the right thing and they're saving these animals. So they start out with great intentions, but it sort of gets out of hand.
Yes, and you know, and you can see how it happens too.
Exactly.
You can go down south into rural Louisiana and see really well-intentioned people, and they just don't want to say no to another dog. But hoarding is also a complex psychiatric phenomenon too. I don't want to, you know, say that there are aspects of it. You know, it becomes a mental illness at some point. But people do have to be very much aware of it. One of the things that wisest things I think I heard about hoarding was from a man named Tom English, who does rescue work near Galveston, Texas. And he said, look, if you have two dogs and you can't take care of them properly, that's hoarding. If you have 10 and you can take great care of them and get them the veterinary care they need and they're in comfortable, clean surroundings, that's not hoarding. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't make the distinction, but it is a occupational hazard for people who do rescue.
Peter, we just have a couple of minutes left. So Catherine writes, and this was something I want to get to, asks if you can recommend 3 or 4 rescue organizations in Miami that fully vet the dogs they rescue. My boyfriend and I are interested in adopting. Are you aware of any here?
You know, I don't know the rescue community in Miami per se, but I think if you if they talk to their veterinarian to start with, as they meet other people, you know, just talk to other people you know who have rescue dogs and find out what their experience was. You know, I suspect that if they went to either Urgent Dogs of Miami, look them up, or Pets Trust Miami, I don't know that they actually do direct rescue. I'm not sure, but they may be able to steer them in the right direction.
Well, I also want to say to Catherine that in the book, Peter does list a lot of organizations. First, I just want to say that there are rescue organizations for almost every breed of dog. If you're looking for a specific breed, and maybe they could contact Peter Labs for Rescue or one of the ones listed in your book that could recommend an organization right here in South Florida.
Lots of them, and you know, you can adopt. I mean, look, Labs for Rescue Dogs don't just come to New England. I mean,
right.
So, you know, transport might be an issue if they don't regularly adopt out in Florida, but there are, you know, humane societies, I know, on the west coast of Florida, they get a lot of dogs from other parts of the south, but you've got your own problem right there, you know, in Florida. I would just ask around. I would start with a veterinarian and see what they might recommend.
Okay. Well, Peter Zeitlin, a journalist. Work has appeared in the Boston Globe regularly, the Christian Science Monitor, Parade Magazine, Los Angeles Times. His book is Rescue Road, One Man, 30,000 Dogs, and 1 Million Miles on the Last Hope Highway. Facebook.com/Rescue Road Trips to follow Greg Maley, and rescueroadbook@gmail.com to talk to Peter Zeitlin. Peter, good luck with the book. Thank you so much for writing it. And as Greg Maley says, he, you know, saves one life at a time. Maybe you've saved a lot with your book. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, and happy holidays to everyone.
And to you. Thanks so much.
Of course. And thanks for tuning in today. This program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction by Paul Leary. Associate producer is Polly Landis. If you want to hear it again or pass it on, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Then there's the Topical Currents Facebook page online. And Topical Currents takes a holiday hiatus the rest of the week. We return Monday with a special rebroadcast about suicide facts and prevention with Switchboard of Miami experts. Of course, the holidays can be dreadfully difficult for some people. We hope everyone gets through and hangs on.
And we wish you all very, very happy, safe holidays.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.